Thank you. Now's the bit where you can sit back and relax. Are you excited about Christmas? I wonder, oh good. I wonder what you're most looking forward to. Is it seeing the Christmas lights being turned on? I know that's already happened, but was that the high point? Or eating the turkey with all the trimmings? Opening Christmas presents? Listening to the 9 lessons and carols from Kings? Or maybe watching Love Actually again, or whichever your famous Christmas film is? Visiting family and friends? Or the possibility of some snow on the rooftops? So many lovely things to look forward to at Christmas. But not everyone looks forward to Christmas with unbounded enthusiasm every year. Sometimes we have circumstances that, you know, when it's not quite right for us, we're a little bit worried about things or other. And it can be a difficult time for people. And if you have mixed feelings about it, you're not alone. I know of this couple, husband and wife, newly married, wife pregnant. They had a very difficult journey to do. That was 2,000 years ago. Yeah, you know which couple I'm talking about, don't you? I imagine that Mary and Joseph were looking forward to their, what we now call Christmas time, with mixed emotions given all that had gone on in the weeks leading up to that and what they were looking forward to, what was going to happen, and the uncertainty of it all. They didn't know how things would turn out, but they could rely on God's promises delivered by angels and dreams. I say, I imagine that's what it's like. I mean, it's really hard to imagine what it would be like to be forced to leave your home because of a foreign government's interference and be forced to flee from persecution, which they had to do later on. Very tough, I imagine, but very difficult for you and I to appreciate in our lives today. Just as it's very hard to comprehend what it's like for families in Gaza, Syria, Lebanon, Ukraine, and all these other places where it's simply not safe for ordinary folk to stay because of the conflict and persecution. But I think Jesus understood what it was like to live in those turbulent times. Sorry, the picture's a little bit dark. I like the picture of Joseph, Mary and the donkey. I think more than any other at Christmas time. It's kind of universal. You get lots of pictures about Christmas time with Bethlehem and the wise men and the shepherds and the angels. But every artist draws a different piece of imagery. They imagine it slightly differently. But I find nearly all the images of Mary and Joseph, they look pretty much the same. There's Joseph, Mary on the donkey. It's in a rugged terrain. It's a few miles outside of the city. Their journey's nearly over, but you sort of sense the effort they have to go through to make it. And I feel it grounds me in that it disguises this momentous event that's about to happen. You sort of can't see it in the picture, but you know it's there because we know the story. It's like life goes on, normal life, underneath all the Christmas provides, all the glitter and so on. Normal everyday struggles alongside hope. And they were blessed and they had this hope from God. And we're blessed too, even more so, because we know the outcome of their story. Our hope, if you like, is even more solid. Now, they had to travel at a very inconvenient time from Nazareth to Bethlehem. I reckon that's a journey of about 100 miles and would have taken several days, all for this government census. Just imagine if all of us had to travel back to our father's place of birth in the run-up to Christmas. Oh gosh, what a nightmare. I'd have to go up to Berwick-upon-Tweed. That's 400 miles. 400 miles at Christmas time. I mean, I wouldn't trust the trains, or the planes for that matter. And driving on the roads, well, you know what it's like with the roadworks and the congestion and trying to find a service stop that would be open for, you know, loos and coffees. Gosh, you know, I think even today, if we all had to do that, it would be probably as quick to go by donkey. And I wonder which of you would have to travel the furthest. I'm sure somebody would have to beat 400 miles easy. Of course, as you know, the Bible doesn't actually say that Mary traveled by donkey. But she probably did. I mean, it was the way people got around if they had a long journey, if they weren't walking. It was, if you like, what the car is for us today. you loaded up your donkey and you headed off on your 100-mile journey or whatever. Unless, of course, you were wealthy. I mean, if you were wealthy, you probably had a camel and you went with caravan. Sorry. See, this is what happens when you use computers and artificial intelligence. They recognize the words, but the computer doesn't understand the meaning. Yeah, sorry about that. I guess it's a case of we all interpret and react to the words we read or the words we hear in our own way based on our own experience. Language isn't that sort of exact science like computers want it to be. But moving on, I'm going to give you some history. And just a little word of warning, I got most of my history from the internet. So it's possible that some of the facts aren't exactly correct. But I think it's pretty close, or close enough certainly for this morning. So what you have to understand about the context that Mary and Joseph found themselves in was that Rome had conquered Judea back in 63 BC. And Caesar Augustus, who was also known as Octavian, came to power in 27 BC, and he ruled it all the way through to 14 AD, or thereabouts. He was seen as a very great Roman emperor. And the Romans were great conquerors and builders. They liked to count things in order to manage everything in their domain. Now, there's some debate by scholars and historians about the census referred to in Luke, because according to some of the secular records we found, Caesar Augustus invoked censuses, for the whole of his empire in 2 BC, and then later on in 6 to 7 AD. And it's the latter matches when we know that Quirinius was governor of Syria. But those dates don't quite match with when we now think Jesus was born, or when a lot of scholars feel Jesus was born, which is around 6 to 4 BC. Now, some of you, probably like me, thought it was 0 BC or 0 AD, because honestly, that's what I thought it was. I'm a computer scientist, you see, so we always start counting at zero. But actually, there's no 0 AD or 0 BC. You go from 1 BC to 1 AD. It jumps. And actually, the whole BC-AD system was invented by a Greek monk called Dionysius, based on some research and calculations he did back in 525 AD. But we don't know how he calculated it. We don't know whether he had more information than we have today that's since been destroyed, or whether he had less information or whatever. But he came up with that date. And historians, like scientists, are forever making adjustments and corrections. And so looking back at other records today, there's a sort of general view that, well, it was probably a little bit before then, around 5 BC, give or take. And it's difficult for us because we're used to dates and times being very, very exact. What with our computers again and our atomic clocks. I mean, we even have leap seconds. Did you know that? We measure things so precisely. But you only have to go back a couple of hundred years and you realize that calendars were much more fluid and variable. If you go back to 1751, for example, here in England, we changed from Julian to the Gregorian date system. And New Year's Day became the 1st of January, rather than the 1st of April, as it had been before, which confuses me. And in that year, they lost a year and 11 days in September, which is bizarre. You see, top corner there, you went from the 24th of March, 1751, to the 25th of March, 1752. And then I think it was the 4th of September, jumped to the 15th of September. So things kind of moved around. And if you were in Scotland, you were in a different system from about 1600. So you can see the problems and the uncertainty historians have trying to match up dates because everybody's using a different system. But I digress. And don't worry, I'm not going to test any of you on this later. You see, the dates aren't important, are they really? I mean, how we choose to label a particular year is kind of up to us. The whole BC thing is a man-made invention, if you like. What's really, really important are the people and the events. How we do back calculations, well, that's, you know, on our view of calendar, that's up to us. The people and the events are the most important thing. So do I think Luke got his facts wrong? No, I don't think so. I mean, we know Quirinius was governor of Syria in 6 AD, but he must have held high positions of office before then, and there's nothing stopping him being governor of Syria before then, and then reappointed, because it was a temporary appointment, I understand. And there were many interim censuses taken across the regions for which records are patchy. So, yeah, sounds fine by me. So, yeah, there's nothing here in the secular records to disprove what Luke is saying, that there was a census in Judea a few years before Herod's death, which we now think was 4 BC, but, you know, plus or minus, and led by Quirinius as part of global census taking. And neither is the need to return to your ancestral home that unusual around that time. Many of the outlying provinces, and Judea was an outlying province to Rome, did it this way. And I imagine it was because with a rolling census, you could avoid the census or get counted twice, because it took several years to do the census if you moved around. But if you had to go back to where your father was born, your house, if you like, you'd only get counted once. Because that was it. The census wasn't just about counting heads. It was how you paid your taxes and how you declared your allegiance to the divine Caesar Augustus. See, Caesar Augustus, as well as being very successful in Roman times, he was extremely rich and powerful, and he liked luxury, and he really did consider himself divine. He kept a diary listing all his accomplishments, battles won, political and financial achievements, and he had them carved into two massive bronze pillars, and these were copied throughout the land. Res gestae divi Augusti, the deeds of the divine Augustus. Now, I think there's a wonderful, wonderful irony in all of this. Because I imagine in my head, and this is just my imagination as to what it might have been like, but I imagine in Bethlehem a very impressive government building, somewhere in the centre probably, and a long queue of people from all walks of life, tax collectors, priests, farmers, all watched over by Roman soldiers in their nice shiny armour, people waiting patiently to be counted, pay their taxes and swear allegiance to the divine Caesar Augustus. May he live and reign forever. Hail Caesar. They had to do that or face the consequences. I mean, Rome kept peace, but only through martial law, as it were. And all of this organized by Caesar and his minions, issued through decrees probably a few months or a year beforehand. And now imagine, later that same evening, it's dark and the stars are now coming out to light up the sky. And at a small and actually quite unremarkable house in a quiet corner of another part of Bethlehem, there's another queue of people. It's a much smaller queue, but nevertheless, there's a mix of the high and the low, shepherds and kings. And they too wait patiently to give their gifts, but they do so willingly and freely. And they're here to kneel and worship to the real divine king, a baby watched over by angels. And all of this according to God's plan and foretold by prophets hundreds of years before. What a contrast. I mean, here you have the human world and here you have the way God does things. My ways are not your ways, says the Lord. He turns the whole thing upside down. Not many people remember the census of whenever it was that Caesar Augustus put in place, but many, many people remember what happened there at that other little house in Bethlehem. And I wonder which queue you or I would have stood in if we'd been born 2,000 years ago and lived in Bethlehem. Excuse me. Now, this leads me on to the nativity scene, which is another memorable, wonderful Christmas image. And I've got a question for you. I've been asking lots of people when I've been working out this sermon, the same question. Do you remember your first nativity? And do you remember what you were? Lots of people do. It's amazing. I remember mine. I think I was 5. I was a shepherd in my towelling dressing gown with one of my mum's tea towels on my head. And I was quite happy with that. I mean, it wasn't a speaking part, but it seemed fairly important. So that was all right. I know people who are angels. I know somebody who is a gate. It's not a speaking part, it's a moving part, the gate. And that's fine. I mean, you know, I understand the schools want to involve everybody in taking part in the nativity. And it seems much better to me to be a gate than an octopus. If you've seen Love Actually, you know that part. But I haven't yet found anyone who played the donkey, which is kind of odd, because most of the nativity scene images, not that one, but most of them seem to have a donkey in it. But I don't remember any nativities with donkeys in it, except one when we had a real donkey, but that's going way back. I don't know, maybe people don't choose that. Perhaps it's not so good on your CV, acting skills. I once played the back end of a donkey in the school nativity. Yeah, I'd probably leave that off. But that got me thinking. If there's no mention of the donkey going to Bethlehem, or actually in the stable when Jesus was born, but we're pretty sure there would have been one there, then where are all these donkeys mentioned in the Bible? So I looked them all up. Guess how many mentions there are of donkeys in the Bible? All right, let's have a little question here. So I'll give you three answers. About 50, about 100, or about 150. So hands up if you think it was about 50. Okay, a few. How many think it's about 100? A few more. What about 150? And a few again. Okay. You know the answer. It's 93. Which is pretty good, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, almost as many as there are of the word trumpet. Yeah, I've looked that up as well. 93 mentions of the word donkey. And I've been back through the Bible, it's mainly in the Old Testament, and read all those moments where donkeys are mentioned. And it's really quite interesting, because there are donkeys mentioned at all sorts of key moments in the whole Bible story, alongside the really big players like Moses and so on. There's a donkey. And I just hadn't noticed that before. Amazing. So, what I've decided to do is take you on a journey on the back of a donkey. Not 100 miles, but 3,000 years through the Old Testament on the back of a donkey. And you'll see where they appear. Now, the first mention of donkey, you might be forgiven for thinking it would be Noah and the Ark. But there's no specific mention of donkey, just, I think it's animals with hooves, or domestic animals. So, yeah, there would have been a donkey there, but not mentioned specifically. The very first mention of donkey is the donkey that carries the firewood for Abraham and Isaac when Abraham's going to make the sacrifice. Well, there's a key moment in God's rescue plan, isn't it? I mean, this is Abraham, God testing him, the father of the Christian race in a way. So that's a key moment. The next one is Joseph. You know, all know the story of Joseph, but do you remember the donkeys? Because I didn't. The donkeys are loaded with grain and secretly with some silver that Joseph organizes for his brothers to take back to Canaan because of the famine there. I mean, here's another part of the very important story. And here God's protecting his chosen people and allowing Joseph eventually to forgive his brothers for what they did to him. And then we have Moses. Moses put his wife and sons on a donkey when he headed back to Egypt to challenge Pharaoh. Well, gosh, there's another key moment, isn't there? Moses battling with Pharaoh and then crossing the river and so on. Wow. The next one is less well known, and it's about a talking donkey. No, not you, donkey. Shrek, take him away. No, this is the story of Balak and Balaam. Balak is trying to force Balaam to curse the Israelites. And Balaam doesn't want to, but he's persuaded to go along and he sets off on his donkey. And the Lord places an angel that he can't see in the way. And three times the donkey refuses to go on. And three times Balaam beats the donkey until it turns around and says to him, "What have you done to make you beat me these three times?" And that's in Numbers. You thought Numbers was the boring book of the Bible, all with lists and counting of things. But look what's in there. What an amazing story. And I'm convinced God has a sense of humor, you know. And there's more. I mean, Samson, in Judges, Samson used a donkey's jawbone to defeat his enemies. And in 1 Samuel, it's a donkey that takes supplies and a very young shepherd boy to meet the then king Saul. That shepherd boy, called David, went on to defeat Goliath and become a great king. And in the story of Abigail and Nabal, she rides on a donkey to meet King David. And in 1 Kings, Jeroboam rides a donkey and faces a lion. And in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, they count 435 camels and 6,720 donkeys that are brought back from Babylon after King Nebuchadnezzar took them into exile. Gosh, donkeys are important. I had no idea. Right, how am I doing? How many am I doing? I think that's 10. I better speed up. There's another 83 to go. No, I'm only kidding. That's the main ones and makes my point. There you can see it. That long journey to get to the birth of our Saviour, and how donkeys played an important part. I had no idea that donkeys played such a role, so many events and so many people over such a long period of time to bring God's rescue plan into action. There is obviously one more in the New Testament there when Jesus rode a donkey and its colt into Jerusalem, but obviously that's for another day. And I just wonder whether any of the donkeys knew what an important part they played in any of those parts of the story. Probably not. I also wonder how much Mary and Joseph realised. It's like the words of the song that we heard the other night at Singing for Fun. Mary, did you know that your baby boy would one day walk on water? I don't think, but I'm guessing, that Mary and Joseph were particularly focused on the 1,000 or so years that had led up to that event, or had any idea what was going to happen in the 2,000 years to follow. They were dealing with things in the moment, trusting that it would all be okay, because it's all part of God's plan. So, by now, some of you are probably wondering, where's Andrew going with all of this? I mean, we've had a history lesson, some maths lessons, we've had stories and jokes about donkeys. It all seems a bit fragmented, and apologies if it does, but I hope you're enjoying it. But I'm now going to wrap it up, and I'm going to make some serious points and ask you some questions. So I'm going to go back to the nativity and suggest that life's a bit like a nativity play, or a series of nativity plays. We play different roles in different circumstances as we go through our life. Sometimes we have a major role, and sometimes we have a minor role. I've got a lead role this morning because I'm standing up here talking to you. On other days, I do stuff behind the scenes. And lots of people have done stuff behind the scenes today. Put out water, organised the notice boards, check that the recording device is there, all these sort of things. And all the parts are necessary for the whole to execute the plan, even if you don't notice them. Now, I know I'm making the same point that Paul does in Romans 12 when he talks about the body having many members and performing different functions, different gifts. But I rather like the nativity analogy. We all play different parts, but it's the same message. We all contribute in different ways. And so I just suggest to you that if you notice someone doing a minor background task, you thank them, because they're doing an important role. And if you're the one doing the minor background task and you're not being noticed, well, take heart, because God will be seeing what you're doing and may well be using you for some amazingly piece of good work further down the line that you just can't see at the moment. And also just tell the deacons, because we really should know who's doing what and be able to thank you. The one thing you probably don't want to be is the audience. Because if you're just the audience, you're just enjoying what's being done, but you're not actually taking part. And years later, you might well be disappointed when you look back and realise, well, actually, you didn't contribute very much to that. True, you can watch for a while figuring out what's going on, but really, you ought to contribute in the life that you lead and the things that you do. My second point relates to the history. How much of the story of Jesus' birth do you actually believe? I mean, the Gospels and the other books in the Bible, they are an historic account of events that took place. They're just as valid as any other secular records from a historian's point of view. And actually, they're backed up by many secular records, even if some of the details don't quite match. Almost all historians don't doubt that Jesus existed, But I get saddened today when I hear about some of the surveys that go on, particularly when they're surveying young people and asking them what they know and understand about Christmas. And it seems to me that for a lot of children, Jesus is alongside Father Christmas, the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny. It's a fairy tale to them, and I find that quite sad. So, how much of this story do you actually believe? And the next one is, what part are you playing today? That little child is looking backwards. But looking forward, I don't think God's finished. I mean, you know, job done 2,000 years ago, walk away. No, that's not what the Bible says. He's expecting us to go out there and make a difference. Go make disciples, love one another, show the world God's way, a better way, because we're not of this world and its ways. So I wonder what God has planned for Milford-on-Sea or for this church. I'd like to be a part of it. I hope you do too. You get more out the more you put in, as the saying goes. And yeah, it would be great to take part and be involved in some great plan, whatever small part you play. What part are you playing and what's to come? But you have to do the right thing, not just anything. And if for those of us who saw the Journey of the Magi recently, you got the similar message then. It's about your priorities and focus. Make sure you're standing in the right line to be counted, if you like. There's a lot of people who'll be in the queue at the supermarket, or queuing for the sales when they open, or waiting to watch their Christmas special or their favourite TV program. It's a minority who are queuing to get into church and to thank God for his wonderful gift, or to serve at a soup kitchen. So are you standing in the right queue? Have you got your priorities? So I hope those questions have given you something to think about, something to mull over this week. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.